all about.
We bring you the world. News Radio 560, KPQ.
This is The Agenda from News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com, where topics of local concern affecting you are open for discussion. And now your host, Michael Knight.
So 15 at News Radio 560 KPQ. Hello there. 39 degrees in Wenatchee. Time for the show. So consider this. What is a state attorney general? Does every state have one? The Attorney General is the chief legal advisor to the state government and the state's chief law enforcement officer as well. In some states, the Attorney General serves as the head of the State Department of Justice with responsibilities similar to those of the United States Department of Justice. So if you want your state to take legal action against an interloper, a mountebank, a charlatan, a doofus, a bounder, or a jackass extraordinaire, you need to make contact with your state attorney general. State attorneys general enforce both the state and the federal laws within your borders because they are sworn to uphold the United States Constitution and laws, as well as the state's, well, you know, so like that. They're working hard to make sure the laws are enforced. But does every state have one? They do, but we elect ours here in the state of Washington. In Alaska, in Hawaii, in New Hampshire, New Jersey, and Wyoming, the state attorney general is a gubernatorial appointee. So there is enough paper mache and boilerplate for you. Now time for some brass tacks with the straight from the AG himself, an interview with Bob Ferguson. We'll conduct that interview in just 30 seconds.
You rarely give your heating and air conditioning system a second thought until something goes wrong. Then it's a panic. Avoid the stress with a call to Central Washington Heating and Air at 663-3557. They can help keep your current system in top shape, or help you select an efficient new Daikin system that can save you hundreds of dollars in energy costs every year. Central Washington Heating and Air is here to help. Call 663-3557 or visit them online at centralwashingtonheating.com.
This is News Radio 560 KPQ. I'm Michael Knight. My very special guest is Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who's in town for the Women's Parade and the Right to Life Parade and a family deal. So congratulations on all your efforts today, and welcome to KPQ.
Thanks for having me in, Michael. Really appreciate it.
What did you learn in the march today as Wenatchee turns out to Memorial Park to have their say?
Yeah, I went to the Women's March today, and a lot of folks there, hundreds of folks turned out, and it's really a chance for me to hear from people in the community about what they're worried about, and for a lot of folks to worry about some issues with the Trump administration, and worry about the impacts of policies coming from the administration that impact their well-being.
There's so much coming from the administration, mm-hmm. some of it on paper, some of it just on tweet. Mm-hmm. It's hard to react to it all. Mm-hmm. How do you stay even with the issues, and how do you respond to people who say, we love the president just the way he is, or, my God, can't you stop this man?
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
Because that's really the two parties that we're dealing with, right? People
yeah.
who love him and people can't figure it out.
And folks are very divided. What I focus on is what I can have an impact on. That is, it's my job to make sure that this president, just like the last president who I filed lawsuits against, Barack Obama, that this president follows the law when enacting policies have an impact on the people of the state of Washington. If I think the administration is not following the law and that harms people in my state, I'm going to file an action against him. So far, we have filed 33 lawsuits against the administration. 18 of those cases, we've had decisions in the federal courts around the country. We've literally won all 18 of those cases, all 18 of them. Haven't lost a single one so far.
So you're undefeated against the president.
Undefeated. So sometimes people say, hey, Ferguson, why are you filing so many lawsuits against the president? I think the better question is, why does this administration continue to enact policies that violate federal law and the Constitution? I think that's the better question. But in the meantime, if they continue to do that, I will hold them accountable.
So it seems easy for you, because if you issue a policy that's in violation of federal law, it seems like you have the advantage in court.
Well, yes. I mean, it's up to federal judges to decide that. It's worth pointing out that in these 18 cases that we've won so far, and it's worth emphasizing, 9 of those 18 are over. There's no more appeals. The other 9, the cases are still under appeal. That these are judges appointed by Democratic presidents and Republican presidents. I don't get to choose what federal judge I get to appear in front of. That's not the way it works. And so, you know, we don't think we're going to win them all. That's not the way the law works anymore. It's not the way it works for the Seattle Seahawks. You don't win every single lawsuit. But the fact that we have literally not lost a case yet, I think suggests rather strongly that this administration needs to do a better job of following the law and following the Constitution.
Do you argue the cases yourself in court?
No, I've never.
You have a team that helps you?
Oh, yes, we have a team. And it's a variety of folks in my civil rights unit and my Solicitor General's office and what we call a complex litigation team. And so it depends on the case, whether it's immigration related or whether it's related to consumer protection, student loans. You get the idea. We have different folks with different areas of expertise. But to prepare for any one argument in a federal court consumes weeks and weeks of total preparation, and my job has just reached a point where it's there's a lot of demands in terms of the work the office does statewide on behalf of all of our state agencies and clients, and that needs my attention too.
But when you bring a case to court, do you supervise the process?
Oh yeah, there is any case that we bring, there are multiple meetings. I get a memo, I review that memo. I'm very much on top of the cases that we bring and approve every single one. And also, the corollary to that is there are cases sometimes my team brings to me, a potential case, that I say, you know what, we're not going to file that case because I think the case is not that strong, or it doesn't really impact Washingtonians, or because I don't think I as Attorney General can bring the lawsuit. Maybe somebody else can, but I don't have what we call standing to bring the lawsuit on behalf of the people. So there's a lengthy, careful process that we go through before filing a lawsuit, and I'm very involved in that entire process.
The process itself seems to be a mystery to some people because we hear so much, especially in the news today, about cases mm-hmm. and rulings and defendants and pleadings
yeah.
and things that we don't know, secrets that only leak out basically through the press. When you went to law school, how do you prepare? Was there any class that said, now you know, Bob, in your future you're going to be working for the state of Washington. You're going to have to know how to do this stuff in this way.
No class could really prepare you for filing dozens of lawsuits against the president, of course. But hopefully what law school prepares you for is to think critically, to not make assumptions, to make sure you're focused on the law and the facts of your case. And that's really important for me that, you know, I'm proud that so far we haven't lost a case. That tells me we're doing a good job of filtering out cases that we think are good cases, where we think the law is on our side, and focusing our resources on those cases. And not just filing a lawsuit so it feels good in a press release or I can talk about it at a rally. That's not why we do it. We do it if we think it's the right thing to do on behalf of the people and we think that someone is violating the law. Typically that's an entity or a business or a corporation. It's a little unusual to have it be the president. That just happens to be the time that we're in right now.
And in looking ahead to the legislative agenda for 2019, you've got a continued list of things that you want to accomplish. Let's start with the ban on high-capacity magazines.
Yeah.
That's something a lot of states and a lot of attorney generals have considered. Both sides of this issue have been considered by attorney generals in different states.
That's exactly right. A lot of your listeners may be surprised to know that in Washington State, there are no limits to what we call a high-capacity magazine. In other words, there's no limits to how many rounds you can put on a weapon.
So if I could figure out a way with 1,000 rounds, that would be legal.
And what you typically see are 30 rounds, 40 rounds, 50 rounds. Walk into Cabela's, they're there. Not behind a counter, just walk in and buy them. They're there, and you can put those on your weapon. A number of states now have limited high-capacity magazines to 10 rounds. Federal courts have upheld those limitations. In other words, we obviously have a constitutional right to bear arms, and that's important, and I support that. But the state, any state, can put certain reasonable limits on that right, just like there's limits to my First Amendment right to speech. I can't shout fire in a crowded theater if there's not really a fire. That's
not without consequences.
Not without consequences, exactly. And so the state can put limits on any right, including the right to bear arms. So I believe Washington State should have a limit on high-capacity magazines. Have proposed a bill to do that. We'll see how it goes. We do feel it has some momentum this year, particularly in light of the fact that last November, for Initiative 1639, which was a gun reform bill, that it passed with 60% of the vote in Washington State. Overwhelming support from the people of the state of Washington voting for that common sense gun reform. We think that gives us some momentum for this one.
Can representatives around the state of Washington in districts that are more rural where they know any gun legislation is going to be scrutinized very, very carefully, do they want any part of this type of legislation? Do you have any support from people who normally would support the NRA?
You know, it's a good question because I think that when it comes to common sense gun reform, that the people are way ahead of the politicians, as evidenced by this initiative. What was in that initiative, one of the main things in that initiative, Michael, was raising the age to purchase an assault weapon, like an AR-15, from 18 to 21. Now, you have to be 21 to buy a handgun, but you only had to be 18 to buy an AR-15. A lot of people thought that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It should be the same, 21. And so I proposed a bill to do that, the legislature. They wouldn't touch it. They wouldn't vote on it. When it went to the people, again, they voted 60%. That's folks all around the state approving a measure like that. So I don't want to minimize the issue you raise, which is, hey, are there going to be a lot of legislators who view voting for a gun reform bill as a third rail of politics, right? Touch it and you got problems.
Everybody in New York knows what the third rail is. People in Washington learn the hard way.
Exactly right. And so is that still the case? Sure. But do I think each time an issue like this goes to the voters and they come back resoundingly in support of common sense gun reform, I do think that helps with elected officials and especially the new elected officials who are coming in. So time will tell. Passing any bill related to guns is always a challenge with the state legislature for the reason you're mentioning. But I'm optimistic this year we have a chance to get it through.
There is a death penalty in the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. I discovered just this week in preparing for this interview that it's still on the books.
Correct. Our state Supreme Court, as many of your listeners probably know, declared that our death penalty in Washington state was unconstitutional as it is applied, as it is actually in practice implemented in Washington state. So, for example, they focus on issues like geographic disparities. In larger counties like King County or Pierce County, the local prosecutors who bring these cases have tremendous resources to bring a very complex death penalty case, and they're all lengthy, and they're all complicated, and they're all expensive. But smaller counties with smaller prosecutor offices rarely, if ever, bring them.
They can't even get in the game, can they?
They don't have the resources to bring them, that's not exactly equitable, right? If one commits a crime that is death penalty eligible, you should be treated the same across the state. It shouldn't depend where you commit that crime on whether or not you get the death penalty or not. In any event, the Supreme Court said the way it's applied is unconstitutional. That does not mean that the death penalty is off our books. In fact, in the past, when the Supreme Court has said the death penalty is unconstitutional as applied, which it has in our state, the legislature has, quote unquote, fixed the problem, and then death penalties could be brought back. So what I'm proposing, and what many legislators, a bipartisan group of legislators, are signing on to is, to your point, taking the death penalty off the books once and for all. A growing number of states are taking those votes. The Nebraska state legislature, overwhelmingly Republican, voted to abolish the death penalty just in the last couple of years. So there is a greater awareness that the death penalty is expensive, more expensive than life without parole, does not serve as a deterrent, and is inequitable and therefore should be abolished.
And in some cases, it's not safe. The wrong man can be put to death.
Oh, and there's been documentation of that. Just watch the news each month with DNA evidence. You see people convicted of capital crimes, serving life sentences, or even in the most truly outrageous circumstances, being sentenced to death, being released when DNA evidence comes to the fore at some point in the future. So the consequences with the death penalty are obviously very significant now. Look, I am not at all minimizing the impact on families, and I've met with families on both sides of this issues, and they have strong views. Some really want a death penalty. Some think the death penalty brings no closure at all. They'd feel better with, let's end this lengthy appeals process, lock them away, throw away the key for life, and that's what they want. So I understand when it comes to death penalty, principled people can have very different ideas of what's best for our state. But I think the overwhelming evidence now points to abolishing the death penalty as a right approach. My predecessor as Attorney General, Rob McKenna, Republican, he has joined me in calling for abolishing the death penalty. So we see broad bipartisan support for this measure, and I believe this year it really will pass.
And is it important that it be on the books sort of in neutral and not being used, or is it more important that it be off the books entirely?
Well, if it's not off the books, the death penalty can be, to my point earlier, fixed by the legislature. In other words, the legislature could, theoretically, right, could say, hey, you know what, we're going to create a state fund, funded to the tune of many millions of dollars, which is what it would take, and then if there is a death penalty eligible case in any small county, they can use those resources to bring a death penalty case. Well, I'm not sure if that's what the majority of taxpayers in Washington state want their taxpayer dollars to be used for, but there could be ways for the legislature, potentially, right, to address the Supreme Court's concerns, and then prosecutors could bring back the death penalty. So this is not a theoretical situation. That's happened in the past where the Supreme Court has declared unconstitutional and the legislature has fixed it. My feeling is the death penalty just simply should be abolished, taken off the books, and let's bring this conversation to an end.
Another crime that is a crime that's on the books, a little less draconian, is the purchase of tobacco at the age of under 21.
Yeah.
I can't remember when I last purchase cigarettes, but I remember the first time I tried was from a machine, and I was so nervous because I was underage, but I managed to get those cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
How important is that for the state of Washington to regulate the age of purchase?
Yeah, and this is an important bill because it applies not just to cigarettes, which, of course, are tremendously harmful to individuals once they're addicted, but to vaping products. Right now, the age to buy vaping products, and the use of vaping products, by the way, with teenagers has skyrocketed.
It's like they're playing with a toy.
Yes, but getting just as addicted to the nicotine that's inherent in that product. So the proposal is to raise the age to purchase vaping products and tobacco products from 18 to 21. More than, I want to say it's about 400 local jurisdictions have done this around the country, and a number of states have as well. The evidence is overwhelming. If you're not smoking, addicted to cigarettes by the time you're 21, there's only a 5% chance you ever will. Big Tobacco understands that they want to get you addicted to nicotine and cigarettes. They need you smoking when you're a teenager. And all the evidence points to if you raise that smoking age, it makes it that much more difficult for sophomores, juniors in high school to get cigarettes from their friends because their friends are in high school. They're not 21-year-olds. Now, will kids still try to find a way to work around it? Of course. But those jurisdictions that have raised that smoking age have seen a significant decrease in teenage smoking as a result.
Which way do you think it's going? Are teenagers smart enough to know that smoking's not bad for them? Are smoking's not good for them? And that it's a bad habit that they've watched their parents and other people struggle with?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not sure I can
answer. We know what they think about anything, do we know what they think about that?
What I can say more specifically is on vaping products. We had high school students testify and forward this bill just a couple days ago in Olympia, and I spoke at some length with a young woman who's in sophomore, and she became addicted to vaping. And she talked about the sweet taste that's provided in those vaping products, that kids think it is just that they, with vaping products, do not realize the health consequences. I think with cigarettes, there's more of an awareness, but not so much with the vaping. And, you know, she talked about at her school how they literally have to limit it down when school's in session at certain times down to one bathroom for the boys and girls near the principal's office because during breaks, so many kids go into the restrooms and vape. That's become that level of a problem in her high school. So it's a serious problem with significant health impacts, and we don't even know all the health impacts for teenagers when it comes to vaping. I think this bill will address that.
Our special guest is Washington's Attorney General. That's Bob Ferguson you're listening to. Bob Ferguson and I will be back right after a few words on News Radio 560 KPQ.
You're listening to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.
Steelink service to Mission Ridge is now operating. This means that instead of schlepping your gear from the end of the crowded parking lot or even having to park down the road, you can get dropped off right up front. Again this year, Steelink is free for anyone to ride. With 7 trips a day, you can pick and choose when you want to head to the ridge or call it a day. For information on exact routes and schedules, visit linktransit.com or call 662-1155.
The Agenda with Michael Knight on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.
News Radio 560 KPQ, Michael Knight and my very special guest, Washington's Attorney General Bob Ferguson. Is there a pressure being Attorney General that we can't appreciate? Is there always pressure on the man on top to get the cases right, to get to bring the right cases, to put the right people in jail, to sue the right folks, to show yourself to the public that you're working on their behalf?
I mean, I don't really feel that. I mean, what I would say is any job has pressure. Any job has pressure. I think folks who have more pressure is, let's say you're out of a job, right? Let's say you're a federal worker right now who, because of the shutdown, can't work and has a hard time putting food on the table for your family, or someone who's making a minimum wage, working two jobs, trying to provide a better life for their kids. That strikes me, if I was in that circumstance, as being a lot of pressure. So every job has its stresses, of course. I mean, that's my job's no different than yours or to those who are listening. What's maybe a little bit different about my job is it's very much a public job, right? That my decisions, if I win a case, if I lose a case, make a good decision, make a bad decision, you know, it gets written about and it gets discussed. And, you know, my advice to people who think about politics is have a thick skin. You just can't worry about what critics say. That doesn't mean I don't care. Of course, I care what the people I represent think, but you just can't let that consume you or worry about it or read the comments on newspaper articles. That'll just drive you crazy. And so I'm lucky. I'm one of seven kids. I've got five older brothers. And as I like to say, there's nothing anyone can say about me that my older brothers didn't say. Well,
you survived four older brothers or five older brothers?
Well, five older brothers. Well, four older brothers. I've got there's six boys altogether, one younger brother, four older brothers. So there's nothing anyone can say that my four older brothers didn't say while beating me up at the same time. So it's perfect preparation for.
Did you tell them when you were being beaten up, I'm going to go to law school and I'm going to put a stop to this?
I didn't. The only thing I do tell them once in a while is, you know, the official title for being Attorney General seems ridiculous, but the title is General, right? General Smith, General Jones, General Ferguson. Of course, no one calls me that. Although sometimes at Thanksgiving, I will remind my brothers that they need to address my older brothers as General Ferguson just to give them a hard time.
Well, I hope they just heard that interview. Run that past them one more time. The legislation is coming together to protect consumers in one way, and if anybody needs to be protected from a debt collector, it's the consumers of the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. It's a strange group of people. It's a strange industry, but there's a element of this debt collecting that you focused in on that I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of folks weren't aware, frankly, including me until relatively recently. It's something called pocket service, and what this means very simply for your listeners is, let's say you have debt, and there's a debt collector who's trying to collect that debt against you. They can go to court to try to collect. What Washington State allows, which is rare, only a handful of states allow this pocket service, but what they'll do is they'll file a lawsuit against you, Michael. So they'll serve you with a lawsuit, a complaint. You get the complaint, it looks legitimate, it's got a case number on it. If you call the court, let's say here in Chelan, you call the court up and say, what's the status of this case? What they will tell you is, sir, we have no record of a case like that. Nothing's been filed. So you naturally think, well, either this is not legitimate, they haven't filed it, it's a scam, or number two, I've got time to respond because the case hasn't even started yet. What you don't realize is the clock has started on the 20 days for you to respond to that complaint, even though they have not filed that complaint in court. So after 20 days, that debt collector can now go to the court here in Chelan and get a judgment against you without you ever having a chance to respond to it. They call it pocket service. It's outrageous.
It's legal?
It's legal in Washington State and a very few states around the country. And you don't need to be a lawyer to understand the adverse impacts to consumers. We actually have consumers calling us, who Washingtonians, who receive these complaints and think it's a scam because it's not filed with the court. So you can do everything right as a consumer. Call the court, check on the status of the case. Well, the case has been filed. Why would you think you have to do anything in terms of filing something with the court when nothing's been filed by the debt collector? So our proposal is to eliminate this pocket service so debt collectors can't do that. So it's a transparent process so the consumer understands, hey, this case has been filed. My clock is ticking. I need to get a lawyer. I need to respond. I need to deal with this one way or the other. That's what's fair. So I have a piece of legislation to eliminate pocket service here in Washington State.
So if I were a debt collector and I had 500 cases, I could do this 500 times, and I would find somebody to pay me.
And see, that's why this exists, is for debt collectors. It frankly streamlines the collection process for them in an unfair way for the consumer. All they have to do is serve you with the complaint, wait 20 days, then walk into court, boom, they've got their judgment, and now they can actually start collecting from you. There's just one huge problem. It's not fair for consumers. So as Attorney General, you know, the law intersects with our lives in so many different ways, and it's my job in part to make sure that that is as fair and transparent a process in an otherwise murky, strange world, the law and courts. But let's not make it any more difficult for folks who are already struggling and may have some debt. Let's at least give them a chance to respond to those complaints when they receive them.
Is the law murky enough across the board for anyone on either side of any issue to successfully argue if they have the right judge or the right jury?
Say that one more time.
No. Is the law that we deal with virtually every day, this one is a good example, but there's many laws that have to deal with all sorts of corporate rules and a variety of different crimes that are available to us.
Yeah.
Is the law murky enough the way it's written for anyone to argue on either side of the law? I mean, that's a law practice that you do in law school, right? You don't know what side you're going to defend or prosecute. You just find out before the case and you begin arguing.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that a lot of the work, for example, that we do in our office, if there is a lawsuit going on, it's murky enough that the other side thinks they've got good arguments and we think we've got good arguments, and it's for a court to decide. Sometimes the cases are black and white, but that tends to be the exception. If folks are spending the resources to go to court and have a battle in court, well, presumably there are reasonable arguments on both sides. That's why we have the judges and the justices to call balls and strikes and make those decisions. That's why when I mentioned earlier, hey, we haven't lost a case yet against the Trump administration, that is highly unusual for the reason you are pointing out in your question. The law is typically murky. There are good arguments on both sides. You can't win all the time. It's not the way it works. So typically that's the case. And it's our job, of course, as lawyers for the people of the state of Washington, to make as effective legal arguments as we can on behalf of the people we serve.
We take a census every 10 years. And the, I guess the use there mostly is to reapportion our congressional districts. For it's nice to know who's living in the country.
But we
use it for different things.
And also for federal funding. You pick the federal program that is based, how much Washington State gets in huge programs that have federal funds is based on our population. So knowing the precise count as closely as possible of everybody living in our country, which the Constitution requires, citizen or non-citizen, the Constitution says a count of everybody is critically important for many reasons.
Some of the questions we ask on the census form allow people who are citizens or not citizens to react to the point where they don't want to take part.
Correct.
And that's probably intentional.
Yeah, so right now, I mean, the goal of the census has always been to maximize participation, because the Constitution itself says that the federal government must do this periodically and count everybody. The Constitution's clear on that, and courts have been clear on this, that it counts everybody. As you know, the Trump administration, I guess it was last year or so, said they wanted to, for the first time in many decades, ask a question about citizenship, despite study after study after study from the federal government showing if you ask that question, there will be a decrease, significant decrease, in participation of folks across the country. So that is contrary to the entire mission of the federal government when it comes to the census. So we joined other states in challenging that question, which came at the 11th hour and 59th minute without any study, without any analysis, and a federal judge back east declared the administration's actions and their process, most importantly, in reaching the decision that they wanted to ask a question about citizenship to be illegal and struck it down in like a 220-page decision.
Is that going to work all across the country this time, you think?
Yeah, so that is as of right now, the federal government cannot ask that question. They will undoubtedly appeal that case. Could very well go before the U.S. Supreme Court. But it's worth pointing out, Michael, that in most of the cases that we win, and this is a good example, we're not winning because of some big constitutional argument around due process or equal protection. It's actually, more often than not, because the federal government refuses to follow a federal law. It'll put any audience to sleep, but it's called the Administrative Procedure Act. And what it requires the federal government to do before enacting big policies is to basically take basic steps, public comment, do an analysis, a pro-con analysis, do studies, that type of thing. You can't just be arbitrary when issuing these decisions. And in the case of the census question, the judge literally said that the federal government ignored all the studies that showed if you ask the question, you're going to decrease participation, and essentially manipulated the data to come to a different outcome. The federal government can't do that. That's not how it works. They've got to have a transparent process, follow that act. They refuse to do it time and time again, and that's why it's cost them in court.
How do you think your administration, the men right now who are running the state of Washington on behalf of the citizens, became so liberal? I'm from California, so it's something that I'm accustomed to.
Yeah.
But in Washington, there are people who just say, my God, Washington is so liberal. You people are so incredibly liberal. How do you do it? What's driving you? Or is it just a reaction to the way people think in Washington or Oregon or California or that West Coast mindset?
I mean, I think of Washington as, frankly, more populist than liberal.
Well, liberal is a bad name now.
Well, I don't think it's a bad name. I just think if I was put a label on the state, I'd say more there's a strong populist streak in our state and a strong independent streak. And it's worth pointing out our state Senate until a year ago was controlled by the Republican Party. The Democrats had a one-vote majority in the state House, so that's pretty divided by the state legislature across our state. I think people think of us as this deep blue state. But when you look at our legislature, for example, it's almost divided right down the middle. Right now, for the first time in a long time, the Democrats control all the branches. But that's been unusual. But I would also say that other states have far more liberal policies on guns, for example, or other issues than Washington State. So, yeah, I think labels are always tricky. But my sense is, for example, the initiative process that we have, Washington was one of the first states to adopt that and to adopt such a broad initiative process to put really power with the people and requiring reform within government. So I think there's that strong populist independent streak that I see as I travel the state and as a fourth generation Washingtonian. And that's why I think we've seen, even in Olympia, a divided government for so long.
That's the voice of Washington's Attorney General. That's Bob Ferguson on News Radio 560 KPQ. We'll take a quick break, come back in a moment with News Radio 560 KPQ's special guest, the Attorney General Bob Ferguson.
You're listening to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com. Tonight on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.
News Radio 560 KPQ, our special guest today on The Agenda is Washington's Attorney General Bob Ferguson. Mr. Attorney General, or General, as they say, in your family at Thanksgiving. What's on your desk at work today?
Well, it's a full desk at all times.
Do you keep a clean desk, or do you have to see everything there in front of you?
No.
Do you know right where it is?
I should not admit this, but my home office, my work office is a bit cluttered. So I take no pride in that. It's just the way that I am. So, look, it's more than a full-time job, in part because, you know, we've chatted about some huge, big cases or potential legislation, and that is literally one tiny fraction of the work that we do on behalf of the state as a whole and the people of the state. So the one thing many things I love about my job, but one is that every day brings new issues. It might be relatively obscure, but critically important to the Department of Corrections, for example, or to a state legislator, or some branch of state government that may not make the front page of the paper, but it's critically important that we give really good legal advice to our clients as they make their decisions. And obviously with what's going on at the national level, there's been a greater scrutiny on the office and on the work of the office, and I'm very much aware of that, and that has taken a certain amount of my time to make sure that we are thoughtful in the cases we bring against the administration, because frankly, I'm mindful that I do that on behalf of the state of Washington, and not everybody agrees with those decisions. So it's important to me that I'm thoughtful about those and that we have success with them.
Do you recall the first time you argued in court? First time you showed up and stood on your hind legs, as they say?
I remember it very clearly.
What happened?
Yes. It actually was memorable in a lot of senses. I was in King County Superior Court. Judge Downing was the judge, a very respected judge now, who's retired recently. And when I went in, the attorney for the other side was from out of state. And I remember when he came in, he had like a kind of a leather jacket on. And I remember the judge sort of dressed him down by saying, "Hey, when you're in court, you don't dress so casually." And I was very thankful I was in a full suit and tie, unlike right now in my jeans and my running shoes. But I was very thankful. But it made for a very memorable first time in court to see that in action. I won, which was great. So it got me off to a good start. But, you know, anytime you're in court, you have whether that was a very small case, important to my client at the time, but a very small case.
But you learned to wear a suit, didn't you?
I learned to wear a suit. And whether it's that or whether it's been in a courtroom when we're taking on the president, monumental case. But one thing I always appreciate about the law is judges do not care who's got the loudest voice in a courtroom. What they care about are the facts of your case and the law, and they're focused on that. And a courtroom, if you have a good advocate, is the great level playing field. You can take on a president, you can take on a corporation, take on anyone, if you can effectively make your case. And judges will make their decisions based on that. And I think that's really one of the beauties of our system and really why I became a lawyer.
But it's a good idea to say good morning, Your Honor.
It's a very good idea
to
look the judge in the eye and say good morning, Your Honor, yes.
Nice to have you here today. Washington's Attorney General Bob Ferguson. It's a pleasure talking with you. Let's do it again sometime.
It's a deal. Thanks, Michael.
News Radio 560 KPQ. This is The Agenda.
You're listening to The Agenda.